Okay, home stretch time. So I'm going to move through two things fairly briskly and then slow down for the idea of feeding the hungry heart. Okay? So first I want to talk about dual modes. So you see up here, I'm being dualistic, okay, but you can see basically two distinct ways of experiencing things and operating life, right? And I have, looking across here, these sort of matched pairs. So we know what it's like, for example, to be in a state where there's a lot of verbal activity going on, or the mind's quiet as far as inner language, right? We know what it's like to be thinking about the past or planning for the future or worrying about the future or fantasizing, hopefully, about the future, distinct from really being in the moment, just here and now, really present here and now. You know what that's like, let's say. We also know what it's like to be in a state where we have a strong view, we're attached to our view, over here where we're in don't know mind, let's say. Right? And then way down here, we know what it's like, for example, to have a strong sense of self or minimal sense of self, either self as someone we're thinking about, who happens to have our own name tag, or self as the perspective from which we're thinking. We know what that's like. Interestingly, those two different ways of experiencing or operating in life, which I'm labeling doing or being, in quotes, map to two distinct networks in the brain. The doing network maps to midline circuits that overlaps a lot with the so-called default network when the mind is sort of wandering. And also, the being way of operating and experiencing in life is associated with circuits on the side of the brain, particularly the right side for right-handed people. So let me explain this imagery. This is imagery of people who are doing a self-referential task. Right? They're thinking about themselves in some way. How do I feel about this? What do I like? What happened to me when? Am I a good person? Am I a bad person? Am I both a good and a bad person? Am I really unbounded mind? You know, what's that? Okay. Well, the key word up here is medial. When people are doing that, networks really close to the midline are lighting up. The X's there are millimeters. So those blobs, reddish and orange and yellowish blobs, are regions of activation. This is a brain looking this way, sliced this way. And they're within, all those various blobs are basically within half an inch of the midline of the brain. Okay? Those are the networks that are lighting up when we're doing selfing. There are other networks too, as I say, as you saw in those other pictures, but they tend to be pretty densely associated to midline processing. Okay. In a different study, note that this is far distinct from Gusnard in the previous study, they also gave people tasks where they would be engaged in self-referential processing, looked at the brain, and you see as well that what's happening, especially in this image, is in the midline of the brain. Okay? The X, again, pardon me, is in millimeters. So within a few millimeters of the midline of the brain, that's the white stuff. That's the center of activation. Okay. Now, what they did in this particular study is they did it in two stages. In stage one, they showed people words and then asked them to think about what the words meant about them personally. Are you like this? These were trait adjectives like friendly, lazy, curious, motivated, ambitious, conscientious, grumpy, whatever. So people were supposed to think about how they were like that or not like that. And when they did that, in terms of the blue blobs, that was the blue condition, all right, self-focused condition. The activation, as you see here, is in the middle. But then they said, okay, now look at the same words, but this time, just sort of be with whatever arises for you in response to those words. Don't try to figure anything out. Don't try to decide anything. Just sort of allow reactions to arise and come and go. It was an open awareness condition, right? That's the red condition. And in the red condition, the networks are lit up on the side of the brain. This is a head, basically, in this perspective, so you can see that the networks are on the right side of that brain. Interestingly, people in the first stage of the study, when they were asked to or told to just be with what's there, in a kind of an open awareness, mindfulness practice, they were indeed able to activate those lateral networks for about 10 seconds. Just like a lot of people meditating, you know, breath, 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 shopping list. Bill, money. My partner needs to make more money. Midline, or lateral, midline, lateral. It's like the two-step dance. You're in meditative practice, right? Okay, so that was at the very beginning of the study. And then after 8 weeks of basically an MBSR program, mindfulness training, 8 weeks later, the people in this study were able to stably sustain activation of these networks, okay, on the sides of the brain. I think the imagery is reversed here, so now it's as if we're looking at someone from this perspective and the networks are on the right side of the brain. Okay? So isn't that kind of interesting, first, that there are two different networks? Second, that people can stabilize the activation, they can sustain the activation of the lateral networks that support open awareness, even in just 8 weeks. And probably by then, particularly if they're doing it repetitively, their meditative practice, they're actually building structure in those lateral networks on the side of the brain. Not just more able to sustain activation on them. Yeah?
You said building structure. Do you mean actually building more neurons on that part of the brain?
Yeah, what I talked about at the lecture, the idea of building synapses, they won't build neurons there, basically, because neurons grow in only pretty much one part of the brain, two parts of the brain, really, the hippocampus and the olfactory tubercle, where we smell, and need to form memories of noxious odors, let's say, or good ones. But the point is that you're right, exactly. New synapses are forming there. When people build structure, they form tens of thousands, tens of millions, maybe tens of billions of new synapses, as well as capillaries bringing supplies. So the cortex, the outer layer of the brain, from the root word bark, the cortex of the brain, the outer layer of the brain, gets measurably thicker. Literally like building a muscle. Yeah, that's what I mean by building structure. The idea of neurons that fire together, wire together. Yeah, exactly. That's kind of amazing to think that just 8 weeks can sustain activation of those networks and then increasingly build structure there. Because if neurons fire together, they wire together. Even if we don't have the technology yet to measure, perhaps, the wiring, it's still happening. It cannot not happen. Including sometimes it's a sensitization of existing synapses, because that too is a way to strengthen circuits. So you don't even need to build new synapses. You just sensitize the ones that are already there at the point of intersection, you know, among different neurons.
And desensitize the ones that are in the middle.
Yeah, they're problematic, exactly right. You let them wither away, that's exactly right too. Ones that are not being used tend to wither away in a process called neural Darwinism, survival of the busiest. Brain scientists occasionally have a sense of humor. All right, so moving on. How do we activate the being mode? Now, let's be clear. Both are appropriate. I have clients and kids who could use a little more of this sometimes, all right? But for most of us, me included, modern schools, conventional schools and conventional jobs and conventional culture are an endless stimulation of the doing mode of the brain. And neurons, as we talked about right there, neurons that fire together, wire together. So we're continually strengthening, typically, the being mode circuits over here, and we're tending to, as you said, let these circuits wither away, unfortunately. A lot of what we're interested in, a lot of people, both to be more balanced in life, as well as to heal in therapy or grow spiritually, is to get better at the being mode. And to be able to more supply move back and forth between these two modes. How to do that? One is to go into the Bahia, place. Because when we're in the open awareness place, we're just letting things be, right? So every time we, you know, for maybe a minute straight, ideally, get those neurons firing together, every time we just let the scene be the scene, the heard, the thought, the self, every time we just let that happen, you know, we tend to move out into those lateral networks that support open, spacious awareness and being in the moment. More specifically, I have a little list here. I won't do all of it. I'll do one little practice with you that's kind of neat. These are various ways that studies have shown or suggest that various ways to activate those lateral networks. So interestingly, that bird's eye view, that panoramic, you know, 20,000 feet perspective, activates lateral networks. Not knowing, uncertainty, rumor seems to activate these lateral networks. And also, a sense of things as a whole activates those networks. A sense of things as a gestalt. Sends the light of those networks. So I thought what we could do is a little practice of whole body awareness, which I found myself as a kind of trick, in a sense, that's more than a trick, it's a powerful method of supporting this lateral network activation, and it's a nice doorway into open awareness. So I thought you might like to want to try it here. To go into this, I can tell you from my own experience, I think there are some people this is a little harder for. There's some people that it just is real easy for. I think I'm in the middle, honestly. It took me a while to kind of get the knack of this. Basically, if you just kind of watch the mind, using my metaphor of the surface of that awareness is like the surface of a glass of soda water, clear glass of soda water. And we're aware of the surface here. And so in the surface of awareness, there are all these kind of bubbles popping. The way attention normally works is we tend to be aware of one bubble after another, even though we're attentive to one bubble after another, even though there's an awareness of all the sights and sounds and sensations and thoughts that are kind of manifesting at once. Think about the sensations of breathing, being aware of breathing here. Now, you could be particularly aware of breathing around the upper lip. That's where you're bringing attention. But you're probably also aware that there are sensations of breathing elsewhere in the torso and maybe the body altogether. Or if you just relax and say, okay, I'm going to be aware of breathing, oftentimes what will happen is that attention will move from one place to another where sensations of breathing are felt. In this particular practice, what you're trying to do is to widen the spotlight of attention to include all the sensations at once. So instead of attention moving and highlighting from one sensation after another, there's a widening. So in effect, you're attentively aware to the whole field of experience as one single percept in that moment, one single gestalt in that moment. It's as if attention moves. See, the surface of the cup, as it were, the soda water glass, is what we're aware of. But what we're attentive to is just a small fraction of everything we're kind of aware of, which is more in the background of awareness. In this practice, you're taking the spotlight of attention to include the whole cup, the whole surface of all the fizzing that's occurring, particularly with regard, in this practice, to the body sensations of breathing. We won't do it here, but if you want to, as a practice, you can take it out further to awareness of the body as a whole, and then even further to awareness of all experience as a whole, as one unified moment of awareness in which it's all one thing. And that, basically, is the state of mind of the fifth jhana factor, akagata, unification of awareness. Singleness of mind, it's called, which experientially, when it's strong, has a kawoosh kind of feeling to it of all of experience present at once, moment after moment after moment after moment. Okay? So let's try it here. And it's natural for the sense of the whole to appear for a second or two and then kind of crumble. And then you get better and better at it with practice. So we'll just do this for a few minutes. So to begin with, survey the sensations of breathing. Is there a sensation of breathing, for example, in the belly? The chest? Inside the throat? Around the upper lip. Even subtle sensations in the hips or shoulders or neck or head as the chest rises and falls as you breathe. Okay, and then see if you can kind of receive the breath in awareness, and receive it in the body, relaxing. And be aware of the sensations of breathing in the whole torso, the belly and the chest. And inside the throat and lungs, all those sensations, especially the belly, the chest, and the lungs, all those sensations known together as an integrated whole. This experience crumbles, so okay, see if you can go back to it, sense of the breath as a whole. And then even expand further, if you like, to include sensations of breathing around the nose and upper lip, the mouth perhaps. Even the neck and head or hips. Abiding as a body breathing, aware of all the sensations of breathing at once.
including all the sensations of breathing in the field of attention. Regenerating the sense of the breath as a whole, attentive to all the sensations of breathing as an integrated process of breathing, abiding as this process. No resistance to it, given over to it. All the sensations of breathing appearing in the field of attention, moment after moment. Okay. Coming back. As you like, opening the eyes. Seeing what this is like.
a small point, like a lot of teachers, often Tibetan teachers, I think there's a lot of power in brief practices. Just trying, especially trying something new for 10 minutes, 5 minutes, a few minutes. Because then it's possible to sort of both bring some real oomph to it, some enthusiasm, some vigor. Also, if it doesn't work out, it's just 10 minutes. So anybody want to share about that or a question about it, and then we'll keep going? Yeah.
I had a little trouble when I was trying to visualize all the components, you know, like the breath coming out the belly, the diaphragm, the chest.
Yeah.
All that. And then I realized I was trying to control that, and my breathing was becoming labored.
Yeah.
And very unfulfilling. I wasn't getting anything I needed from the breathing.
Yeah.
Then when I started letting go, it was a heck of a lot easier.
Well, that's good. Good lesson in general. Yeah, and it's about sensing, you know, the elements, and just letting attention include them all. Attention selects out of the field of awareness what we're focusing on. We're aware of other things in the background, but we're not attentive to them. We're just talking here about widening the field of attention. Yeah. Anybody else? Maybe one more person? Yeah.
I'm just curious how eyes open versus eyes closed meditation might tie into this, sort of the visual centers of the brain. And
yeah.
How, I was just thinking that attention and how it, or why it tends to become very objective.
Yeah.
We really hone in on one thing, a cup or a shoe or whatever it might be, and how vision seems to really kind of function the same way.
Mm-hmm.
That we almost always are focusing literally our eye on a thing.
Yeah.
Versus in some of my open eye meditations that I've worked with, broadening just my visual perspective to sort of suppress what's in the center of my vision and start to try to perceive more of what's on the periphery.
Yeah.
And how that seems to either cross over or affect other ways of my thinking.
All right. Yeah, bringing up the sort of trade-offs, really, the pluses and the minuses, costs and benefits of eyes open or closed meditation. As you know, in Buddhism, there are different traditions. Theravada tends to be more eyes closed, Zen, more eyes open, Tibetan, kind of some open, some closed. What works for you depends on the person. It is true that probably about 40% of cortex is devoted to visual processing. So to go to your point about language, if we shut down visual processing, we're going to deactivate a fair amount of neural activity, neural processing, and foster a quieter mind. On the other hand, throughout our waking hours, most of the time our eyes are open. And so learning how to operate in a meditative way with eyes open, you know, it's a higher bar maybe, but it's a good bar to sail over, to be able to let the world be what it is, even with eyes open and the intensity of visual stimuli. And then it can help to sort of defocus, to just, you know, to kind of relax focus and let the world come to us. Going to my point earlier about grasping and seeing and executive functions and selfing being pretty intertwined in evolution and in personal development, a lot of what helps constitute a sense of self in the baby is the repeated process of reaching and grasping. For example, which is very directed visually, particularly babies that are not blind. So if we can relate to what we see, not as almost visually going out to it, but letting it come to us, that's an interesting practice with sight. You see the distinction? A lot we see something and it's like, it's almost, it feels like we're going out to it, and it's different to be more yin, in a sense that we're receiving sight and allowing it to just simply arise. Detail. Okay, so moving on, I want to bounce out to, I'm going to fast forward, sorry, here we go, my thing about liking and wanting. Here we go. So this is really central to Buddhist practice, this distinction between liking and wanting. A little quick review. As someone said, the chain of dependent origination, the Buddha's model, this, you know, chain that goes round and round, beginningless and endless, as he said. In this sequence, in this chain, there's a critically important sequence that's very psychological. That sequence is what the Buddha called contact, or in Western psychology we might call a stimulus, a moment of perception of a stimulus. Something happens. There's a sound, a bell. There's a facial expression near us, you know, a frown, a smile, or internal stimulation. The great majority of the inputs into the brain originate inside the body. There's a lot of internal stimuli. Right? So something happens, there's a moment of contact, and then what happens in the processing chain is the feeling tone of it, or the hedonic tone in Western psychology. Is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? Right? There's the sound, then right on the heels of it, is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? And then in the sequence, it goes to craving and clinging, and then suffering. Craving is kind of a, you know, it's sort of a basic, the root of the word for craving in Buddhism, tana, is thirst. It's kind of a basic thirst, a basic, you know, wanting it, but it hasn't gotten too organized or elaborated or compounded or developed. And then it tips into clinging, where we're really engaged with getting that thing and holding on to it or getting it, or because it can be balanced either way, we're clinging to pushing it away. Right? We cling to that which is pleasant to keep it. We cling to that which is unpleasant to get it away. Okay? That's the sequence. Well, in the movement from feeling, the feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, to craving, right there is an opportunity to cut the chain of suffering. And that's what equanimity practice is. So we can be with the pleasant, we can be with the unpleasant, we can be with the neutral without getting reactive about it. We might respond to it in a wholesome way. We pull the hand back from the hot stove. We drink the glass of water when we're thirsty on a hot day. But we don't get upset about it. It may be unpleasant. That's the first dart the Buddha talked about. But then we don't add second, third, fourth, fifth darts to it of our own reactive cascades, driven by craving and clinging, and typically saturated with self. So that's the Buddha structure. Interestingly, in the brain, there are distinct nodes that do liking distinct from wanting. So, for example, and you can decouple these. For example, we can like something and not want it. We can want it but not like it very much. We can also both want and like, or neither want nor like. Little example, imagine you're having dinner with friends, and they feed you incredibly well and eat like a pig. You're stuffed. And then they bring out this remarkable dessert, psychotically incredible dessert, right? Insanely great, Steve Jobs would say, or something like that. So you have a piece. Oh, my God, it's so good. And then, they say, come on, half seconds. You go, oh, okay. In for a penny, in for a pound. Better hung for a cow than a sheep, right? That's an English proverb. I like it a lot. All right, I'm going for it. And then you're just like about to throw up. You're just so stuffed. They say, come on, try one more. Oh, no. They look. They give you a spoonful of this really great dessert, and they put it on your tongue. And they say, do you like it? Does it taste sweet? And you go, yeah, it's fantastic. And they say, do you want any more? No! So you can imagine that liking and wanting are decoupled right there. You're satiated, you're full. Or flip the other way. I remember going to like Vegas and Reno and watching people play the slots. Like they want to pull that lever over and over and over again. And even when it pays off, watch their faces. They're like masks. Nothing changes. Or drug addicts will often, they just need to shoot up, but they don't particularly enjoy it. They need it, they want it, they've got to have it, they crave it. But it doesn't move their needle. So you can see the decoupling of liking and wanting. So the trick a lot in life, certainly for householders who are awash in pleasant and unpleasant, is to enjoy what's pleasant and like what's pleasant without getting attached to it.
without tipping into wanting, problematic wanting. Or similarly, to dislike, not enjoy, that which is unpleasant, without organizing that very understandable reaction into all kinds of complex fear, anger, stories, resentments, and trouble. Right? That is a ground zero for practice, everyday practice. This tipping from liking and wanting. We have a brain that evolved to like what's pleasant and dislike what's unpleasant. And I think that phenomenon arises in the mind of a Buddha as well. You know, as Andy Alinsky also said to me, very powerful, he said, self is found in the formations. You know, Buddhist model of everything is summarizes it, everything, into five categories, five heaps or piles or aggregates, the skandhas. So the first aggregate is form and the barest apprehension of form. So form is all of materiality, including crazy stuff like black holes and dark energy and quantum weirdness. Okay, that's form. And the barest experience of form, there's something there. Okay, that's the form aggregate, and which is like half psychological, half material. And then the other four aggregates, they're all psychological. The second aggregate, is, as you probably know, is the feeling tone. Is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? The third aggregate is perception. In other words, categorizing it, conceptualizing around it, often pulling up memory about it. What is this thing? Okay, comprehending it. And then the fourth aggregate, called the formations, it's thoughts, emotions, desires, plans, you know, psychodynamic processes, object relations, paradigms, whatever, all that stuff. And then there's the fifth aggregate, which is consciousness, awareness, which arises dependently on stimulation and is not based on some cosmic underlying field of consciousness, like, unconditioned mind. Consciousness is seen as simply something that animals have. Awareness. Squirrels have awareness. Rats have awareness. A frog is a rudimentary awareness of the moving flock. Okay? Those are the aggregates. So, the trick in practice is to allow the inevitability of the feeling tones to be there. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, right? And even allow some rudiment, some basic categorization to know the difference between, you know, the spoon and the mashed potatoes and the difference between the mouth and the ear, right? That's helpful. But where we get in trouble is when in the formations, you know, of other mental processes and phenomena, we get caught up in wanting and typically saturated with self. Because it's interesting, while a strong sense of I can produce desires that lead to suffering, it's actually, if you watch your own experience, very often the case that there's a stimulus, there's pleasant, there's desire for it, and then an I starts appearing, starts organizing, constellating, lighting up, you know, the circuits start activating, there's more and more sense of me, my precious, you know, that thing I want, right? Isn't that interesting? That, which is another way in the insight around the unnecessariness, if you will, of the presumed I, because you can see it following along the heels of desire. Wanting creates an I would say, at least as much as I create wants, as selfing creates wanting. So you can see that process. So as we relax wanting and craving, that has lots of benefits, including deactivating selfing. So how to do it, right? That's a big, this is a big thing. So in there are a variety of ways. One is to simply track in our own experience the movement from pleasant to desire, from liking to wanting, or disliking to wanting not. It's the same process, however it's balanced, positively or negatively, right? To track that movement. It's interesting that in the Buddha's Four Foundations of Mindfulness, he allocated one of the four, one fourth of them, to mindfulness of the feeling tone, the hedonic tone of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and what happens around it, because it's so critically important to the construction of suffering.
that movement from pleasant or unpleasant, from liking or disliking, to wanting yes or wanting no, right? That movement right there is such a critically important tipping point into suffering. We stumble down the slippery slope as we tip from liking into wanting. So mindfulness of that transition, really, really helpful. And then another one that's really helpful is to notice the suffering that's in wanting itself. Wanting feels contracted. Even if we want something good, the wanting feels contracted. You know, that's helpful right there. Just to observe wanting as a mental content like any other. You ever do that? You know, you want something and you just observe wanting as an experience. Oh, that's a trippy experience. What's it like to really want something? And after a while, it starts losing its power because you can regard it as one more mental content like any other. Hold it in spacious mindfulness. You start getting more and more disenchanted around it. You ask yourself, is there a real I in wanting? You'll never find one. The whole package of I, never present. Is there true happiness in wanting? In the experience of wanting, is there true happiness? Never find true happiness in the experience of wanting. So we become increasingly disenchanted and less driven around wanting, right? And then last, there are certain kinds of pleasant experiences, certain kinds of things to like that actually undo wanting. And that's where I'm going to go right now. Okay, there's certain kinds of really important positive experiences that help undo the machinery of craving.
Is it also helpful to remind oneself that wants are endless?
Great. Wants are endless.
Yeah.
Lots of other things too. I'm for sure not giving a summary list of how to practice with wanting, but I'll do, just for me, these are kind of some highlights, definitely. But you're right, wants are endless. It just keeps coming and going, you know. So the Buddha taught the path, middle way, of being with what's pleasant, participating in life, without getting into trouble. I'll say this one last little point. I myself explore, how do we be passionate, though? Like, what are the places for healthy passion, healthy enthusiasm, or vigor? Or what about social justice? You know?
Sustaining something.
Yeah, and sustaining something. How do we do that? How do we do that? How do we, yeah, including have healthy attachments to our loved ones? Right? How do we do that without tipping into trouble? I like that question because to me, it's really where the rubber meets the road, and it's a hard question. It's easy to be all disattached, non-attached, right, to like pretzels. I don't have a lot of attachment to pretzels. Maybe you have a thing about pretzels. Like, take them or leave them. It's really easy to go into equanimity about pretzels, right? But mess with my kids, you know, and go into pretzel mode, no. You know, or I don't know, something else that I really want. Like, how do we do that? Or how do we sustain vigor for our own practice? Right? That's very interesting. And again, I definitely don't have the final answer on it, but I'll tell you a couple things I've noticed, again, in my own experience, that there can be, to use four words that show up again and again and again in the Buddhist descriptions of how we should be, a mature practitioner, of someone who's admirable in practice, or the way we should be. These four words show up again and again and again. One should be ardent, resolute, diligent, and mindful. Well, those first three. Ardent is enthusiastic and heartfelt. Ardor, you know, ardent. So we're heartfelt about it. We're also resolute. We're determined. And we're diligent. We keep doing the work. We hang in there. Right? We make effort over time. How do we do that? Well, it's interesting to observe and experience that those things can be present. We can feel those ways. There can be heartfelt enthusiasm. There can be strong conviction or commitment to something that we care a lot about, right? But it feels different from I want. You know, just play with it. You know, one could have ardency or conviction about nuclear power. Or one could have ardency or conviction and resolve, let's say, about the welfare of loved ones. One can really love one's loved ones. To see what that experience is like, and then see what it's like to shift over to, like we did on the very first day of this workshop, I want something to be different with the nuclear power. Or I want this to happen in my personal life. Right? Or I want you to be my partner. Notice the difference. I don't know about you, but the I want mode feels contracted, feels tense, has lots of little secondary collateral damage start spinning out in the mind, right? And it just seems unnecessary. Because I can still have urgency. I can still have resolve. I can still have values. I can still live from virtues without tipping into the trouble of selfing and wanting. But I find this as a householder, it's a very important edge in practice to be able to be engaged in life on the basis of wholesome passion and aspiration without attachment. That's a real art. I think of that, you know, like in rapids. I'm not any kind of whitewater rapids guy. I did it once, basically. You know, they have classes, like class 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's no 6. And it's not like the volume knob on Spinal Tap that goes to 11. There's no 6 to stop to 5. 5 plus is the worst. But anyway, Niagara Falls is a 5 plus plus. But anyway, and this, I think, is a class 3, 4 rapid, at least. How to engage passion and engage enthusiasm in life without tipping into selfing and wanting. Okay. So now I want to shift into, if I can, this idea of healthy narcissistic supplies. Okay? Because these supplies feel very pleasant, usually. They're very enjoyable. The trick is to, in this piece of practice, my offering is, the trick is to relate to these experiences and even do things on your own behalf that cultivate these experiences without tipping into clinging to them and thus wanting and suffering and selfing. Okay, so I wanted to do that thing about liking and wanting as a kind of frame to kind of, pardon me, call out some pitfalls. For now, we segue into these really sometimes quite delicious and healing experiences. So, it's very interesting and paradoxical that for a child to develop, that child needs a lot of communications that he or she is special. Right? Isn't that kind of paradoxical? That kids who don't get much, you're special, you're amazing, you're wonderful, I love you above all others. If you don't get that, you know, or I see you, I tune into you, you matter to me. If we don't get a lot of that as kids growing up, in a variety of ways, from caregivers, from siblings, from peers, if we don't get a lot of that, particularly in proportion to our own needs for it, some of us constitutionally, temperamentally, need more of that than others do. That's just the way it is. It's not our fault. It's just the truth. Some kids come out of the box quite stoic and kind of indifferent. Our daughter was born, took one look around, closed her eyes, went back to sleep. My son, he looked around. His first word was hi. That was his first word. Very sociable. Very tuned in socially. People have different temperamental needs for social supplies, right? That said, in proportion to our natural temperament, normal, where we are in the normal spectrum need, did we get enough of those healthy narcissistic supplies of attunement, of resonance, of being seen, of receiving empathy, of mattering, of being special, of being prized? Did we get enough? Right? Some of us did. I think my wife is in the percentage who had, I call it, a wholly benign childhood. She had very mellow parents. They were really nurturing. She had a really tight relationship with her mother. She's, you know, an easy temperament for her. She just got a ton of good narcissistic supplies. Okay? right? On the other hand, I think most people don't, me included. There's something missing, often for many, many people. And that creates, you could call it, a hole in the heart. And then around that hole in the heart, selfing tends to really arise. Either selfing in the form of trying to get, often covertly and secretly, nah, I don't really need compliments. So, what do you think of that pie? You know, whatever, right? Or people get very defended around it, and they get defended around anything that activates the longing for healthy narcissistic supplies, anything that activates the longing to be seen or to be included or to matter, particularly in maybe certain kinds of ways, included or mattering or cared about. They're defended about that because in their history, that longing led to pain when the goods were not delivered or were unreliably delivered. Okay? So what do we do about that now as adults? Here we are. We have the psyches we have, right? What we can do is we can take in those narcissistic supplies, those healthy supplies. We can take them in and gradually fill the hole in our heart. We will not change what was missing then, but we sure can heal and remedy the consequences of what happened back then. Brick by brick, one brick at a time, filling the hole in the heart. Okay? I think it's really important. So how to do it, all right? That's where taking in the good comes in. I talked about this at the lecture. I'll do this quickly. If we really want to help a positive experience, it's not an idea. It's not the idea that you like me. It's the experience of feeling liked. That's critically important. There's a place for knowing conceptually there's a good fact here, but that's just the surface. That's just the entry level. You know, what really matters is converting the knowing of the good fact, the perception of the good fact, to a positive experience, particularly of the kind that will heal this particular issue, which are experiences in the social domain, typically, the realm of feeling seen, mattering, included, cherished, and so forth. Okay? So to really register a positive experience, the brain, unfortunately, is inefficient at registering positive experiences. It's very efficient at registering negative ones. It's like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. So, what can we do? Well, we can help our brain be stickier for positive experiences so that they stick to the ribs, as it were. How do we do that? Three steps, basically. One, we are having a positive experience, and then two, in particular, we extend it in time and space. We stay with it, all right? We let it become as intense as possible. We give awareness over to it. For the dozen or two dozen seconds we're doing this, it's a kind of concentration practice. We're, for a brief period, helping ourselves become absorbed in a positive experience. We're savoring it. We're relishing it. We're letting it fill our body. We're keeping it going. We're preserving sanctuary for it. We're holding out, pushing away obstructions or distractions. So for the dozen or two dozen or three dozen seconds, we can really stay with this experience. And overlapping the second step, we're intending and sensing that we absorb it, really help it sink in. Maybe like water going into a sponge or warmth going into the hands, a cup of hot cocoa. Kids will talk about putting a jewel in the treasure chest of the heart. Those are the fundamental three steps of taking in the good, of really, technically, deliberately internalizing a positive experience in implicit memory. Quick sidebar, not all positive experiences are pleasant. I'm defining positive contextually and pragmatically in terms of its fruits, its results. For example, sometimes it's positive to take in an experience of remorse or chagrin. Let's say remorse at, you know, let's say we're working with the fifth precept, not being intoxicated, not using intoxicants. And we, you know, drink too much and we experience consequences from it. We have some remorse about that. we help that sink in. Or maybe we're trying to help ourselves with anger, and we play back a situation where we got angry with someone, and we feel bad about that for various reasons. So we want to help ourselves really register that healthy wince of remorse to support and fuel our own virtues. So the experience is somewhat unpleasant, but it's positive to internalize it, for example. But, happily, most positive experiences are pleasant experiences. That's good. Okay, so those are the three fundamental steps. And then to name a fourth element, and you'll see what I'm doing with the acronyms, the fourth optional step is to pair the positive experience with some sense of negative material. Making the positive experience in awareness much more prominent in the foreground of awareness, with kind of a dim sense in the background of some negative material. So, for example, if you were registering today a sense of feeling loved, you might also have a sense kind of way in the background of feeling excluded as a kid in junior high and not so loved, right? Or maybe a time when your girlfriend or boyfriend sort of dumped you in high school in a really painful way. So that might, you might have a sense of that in the background, even as in the foreground, you're taking in the sense of love right now, feeling cared about right now. Even if it's not, even if they don't perfectly match. In other words, maybe the sense of love right now is non-romantic. It's just a friend or being part of a group who really likes you. But it kind of goes into and connects with and gradually heals and soothes and eventually replaces the pain related to a wound in romantic love, let's say. That's pairing. So you see the acronym HEAP, HEAP. So it's a different kind of heap from the skandhas or the aggregates. You know, this is a good heap. We're heaping up over time positive experiences inside ourselves. That's the basic method, which now we're going to practice in a variety of ways. So do you have any questions about this method? Yeah. No, not in my mind. But thank you for bringing that up. How, why do you, why does it seem to you to go back to self?
Because if you aren't taking things personally and you realize that there is no self, then those experiences become inconsequential.
I think this is quite, yeah. Yeah, I think what you're raising is very important here. So first of all, those painful experiences in the past did happen, and they have consequences. And those consequences are present in us today, often. We may not be aware of them, but they create a background, a sense of sorrow or constraint in our mood. They often lead us unconsciously to avoid certain situations, which would stir up those, or risk stirring up those painful experiences from our past. They sometimes cause us to look for love in all the wrong places, to soothe those old wounds. So they're consequential. There, in my view, is no I in the specific sense I've been using it. But there certainly is a person that has a nervous system that's a learning system. It's a memory system. It creates structure based on lived experience. And those painful lived experiences, or the unmet normal, natural, deeply important needs for healthy narcissistic supplies not being met, the consequences of that are embedded in our nervous system today. And they are a primary, they are a major source of suffering in general, right? And they also drive a lot of selfing that creates other kinds of suffering too. So what do we do with those things? They're there. They're there. Those causes are there, right? Causes of suffering are there. We need to be ardent, resolute, and diligent and mindful about getting other kinds of causes going. Now, one way to deal with those ancient, those factors, is to just hold them in spacious awareness, just to be with them. Remember I talked about the three major moves? One is to be with what's there, let go of what's there, replace what's there. Right? So that's a very powerful strategy. That's a very good strategy. We just be with it, and we see through it. On the other hand, very often, it's insufficient. I've known a lot of long-time practitioners who are very good at open, spacious awareness, who are still neurotic as hell and suffering mightily. And when they get out of their sweet spot of sitting on the cushion and you're on a committee, like for a sangha, or they're, okay, I see chuckles in the room. Or you're married to them, or you've got a partnership with them, or you're going camping together and there's a little stress. It's what John Wellwood called the spiritual bypass. They haven't really, just mindfulness alone is not often always sufficient. And there you see the Buddha offering many methods in addition to direct mindfulness. And certainly over 2,500 years, we've also learned some other ways to create causes that change the what's in the nervous system. And that's perfectly appropriate. It's perfectly appropriate to do that without necessarily presuming that there's an I. The hand is on the hot plate, right? Do I need to presume an I to pull the hand back from the hot plate? No. Someone is hungry. Do I need to presume an I to get fed? Someone longs for love. There is a longing for love. One looks at it, that's a healthy longing for love. Do I have to presume an I to meet that need? I don't think so. I'm really glad you brought it up, because it's a very important question, and it can seem at first like this, right? And that's why I did my bit about liking and wanting. It's healthy to eat when we're hungry. It's healthy to drink when we're thirsty. What's unhealthy is to crave food and water. When we tip from liking to wanting, that's when trouble begins. We are profoundly social animals. Not the entirety of our suffering, but a lot of our suffering has to do with issues in the interpersonal field. It's natural to want to remedy that, right? That's perfectly, perfectly natural to do it. And we don't need to presume an I about that.
That's with a lot of things. It's like when I learn about something in theory, I understand it. And
yeah.
It's the application of it that becomes more challenging.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah,
we can build up the person. I'm fine with fueling the person.
Uh-huh.
Let's feed persons
uh-huh.
without building up and glorifying and, an ego eye. And that's the art.
Mm-hmm.
The art is to reach for, we're playing with fire here, but I think fire is useful, though. That's why I did my thing first on cautions and pitfalls. But when literally, it's a trick. Someone pays you a compliment. So I'll really push it here, okay? If you have a sense that it would be helpful to you to feel more valued by others, more recognized, more appreciated, more seen, more special to them, someone pays you a compliment. They praise you for something, they acknowledge you for something, or they express fondness or affection to you. How can we really stay with that experience and even magnify it slightly by drawing that person out a little further, even appropriately? Someone that's a true friend, it's okay to do this. How can we do that? How can we open more to this sense of being appreciated and even cherished by this other person? How can we do that and let it sink in to that hungry heart without getting all vain and egoic and uppity about it? That's a class 4 rapid. But I think that's a very cool part of the river. And it's possible to do that. We got to keep our eyes open, you know, because I see also a lot of people, the sort of Tantra Buddhist people, who say, oh, just play with desire. I'm like, be careful, because the brain is designed to want what it likes. So be careful with the realm of liking even. If you're going to if you're going to eat well, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, be careful, you know, right? Because the brain is designed to want what it likes. So you've had your hand up. And,
well, you talked to eventually, you used the word person, because when we were talking about this definition yesterday, you identified a person and defined that as the container of experience, memory, and so on. So I think when you're talking about dealing with these issues, you're really talking about the person. You're not talking about the self.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's exactly right. Persons, baby persons need love, right? Now, in that baby person is, you know, this ongoing kind of process where when the person doesn't get love, the body mind doesn't get love, the baby isn't sitting there like a little arahant going, oh, well, body mind unloved, body mind hit, pain, unpleasant, oh, well, you know. The baby, the toddler, the preschooler, the kid, and we're talking about ourselves here. We're talking about my history, your history, right? The child doesn't just go, oh well, impermanent, compounded, empty, transient process. It goes, wow, you don't love me. I'm not lovable. I am not lovable. A lot of wounding around. Which then generates a lot of suffering now, as well as a lot of selfing, which creates more suffering, and which creates trouble for others. Because people walking around, I look back, my own unhealed wounds around, I'm not lovable, I don't really matter, I'm unwanted. That created trouble in my relationships. I did various things. You know, I was a jerk in various ways, or I was difficult in various ways because of that. So we harm others as well through our own unresolved issues here. So one more person, then maybe we'll do a practice with this. Again, just like you said, I think you're exactly right. As they say at this media lab at MIT, demo or die. In other words, it's bringing it down into practice out of the concepts that it suddenly surfaces these big, very appropriate questions. Well, wait a second here. You know, okay, yeah. So a question about people who had traumatic experiences and then how to help that, including what's often done is exposure therapy, where you expose them to that stimulus, and then the idea is that over time they get used to it. They get habituated to it. Okay.
And what happens in the brain with that process?
Yeah. Big topic, super short, large subject, small answer. So first off, an event that would be traumatic to one person is not necessarily traumatic to the person standing right next to her or him. You know, people will go into combat situations like the Middle East, and there'll be a platoon, an event will occur. One person will be freaked out for life as a result. Another person will be really rattled by it, but kind of okay. Another person will think, man, that was the shits, but is not that bothered by it. You know, and it really varies. What is that? So that's important to appreciate individual differences. The other thing to say is that a lot of micro traumas become a macro trauma. You know, a lot of little things can add up to really have an impact over time. Okay, so the field originally did a lot of exposure therapy. It probably works for some people, but for a lot of people, it just seems to re-traumatize them. And my metaphor from the lecture Friday night, that's like doing one more lap around the track in hell, digging the track deeper each time you go around it a little bit. And a lot of people are not resourced enough, for example, to go back to the root, to have the exposure to what's really difficult. So different approaches work for different people. I think rule one, first of all, do no harm, you know, and caution is really appropriate. That said, there are a lot of things people can do. For one, they can build up resources around it. For two, you know, the truth is, this is my personal opinion, I think metaphorically of a tree going around a rock, you know, that rock is there. That rock affects the nature of the tree, but the tree can keep growing and bear much fruit, right? And I think sometimes we just have experiences and we just happen to know, you know, I should steer clear of that particular kind of situation, because that situation really gets me, it might trick me, as it were. I can ski, especially if I have a brace on, but I need to stay away from moguls. And I think there's a kind of modesty and humility that's appropriate to that, and a wisdom and a kindness to oneself, and not over-challenge oneself and not be unkind to oneself about, hey, I got a trick knee. It happened due to causes. It often happened when I was innocent and doing a good thing, and I just got nailed, you know. I was walking through the crosswalk of life, and it was a green light, and some driver just ran a red light and took me out. Something happened. Not my fault. But as a practical problem, here it is. What do I do? And so I think that. And I think gradually there are increasing methods. You know, the Pentagon estimates that 30% of the people coming back from the Mideast have PTSD. And that's the Pentagon. No major fan of mental health traditionally. And they're desperate, by the way. And so, because, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, they are desperate. They're trying all kinds of stuff. I have a friend who's a yoga psychologist, Richard Miller, Yoga Nidra. He's created this protocol called iRest, Integrative Restoration. Basically comes from an ancient Hindu teaching. He secularized it, like John Kabat-Zinn secularized, you know, Zen in terms of mindfulness-based stress reduction, or peace of Zen. And the Pentagon is paying him money and doing research on this Yoga Nidra clone in soldiers coming back. I mean, they're looking for anything that works, for example. So there's a lot of new technology for trauma that's really quite helpful. Different things work for different people, different methods at different times, but I think there's a lot of good stuff. So, moving on, so let's talk about some of the ways to take in the good, all right? And so I want to do a kind of a couple of practices with you, talk about them, and then maybe do a couple more, all right? So the first one is around self-compassion. Self-compassion, you know, Pema Chodron, I don't have that quote here. There's a Pema Chodron quote. She says, the essence of Buddhism is compassion. She's more in the Tibetan frame, of course. But still, it's Buddhism. You know, the essence of Buddhism is compassion, which carries within it a recognition of interdependence and a lack of self. The essence of Buddhism is compassion, and the essence of compassion is compassion for oneself. Self-compassion. Self here defined as person compassion. Okay? All right? So, a lot of research on self-compassion these days, books about it, very powerful. Hard for a lot of people to do, so that I have a series of little neurological tricks for it, so I'll get to that in a second. And then I think what I'll do is segue from self-compassion I'll just do this part, because it'll involve in it a sense of being cared about, and we'll talk a bit about it. And then I'll move into feeling prized and feeling like a good person. Okay? All right, you want to try it? So self-compassion. This might be real easy for you. It might be quite hard. And like I said before, in the networks of the brain, when you try to do something positive, sometimes what that associates to is an obstruction. So sometimes you can't get past the obstruction, and you just have to practice with it. Other times you can be aware of the obstruction for a few moments, recognize it for what it is, and then bring the spotlight of attention back to the positive practice you were doing. So, to begin with, getting a sense of being kind of present here. Eyes open or closed, as you like. And this practice is not a pure mindfulness practice. You're going to be working with the mind.
while simultaneously, of course, being mindful of what happens in the mind as you make an effort in the mind to try to put certain wholesome logs on the fire, as it were. You're trying to stimulate certain positive causes here. And then you're also being mindful of what the result is. So we'll do this in three steps. In the first step, bring to mind one or more beings that you know care about you. Could be beings in your life today or in your past, humans, pets, animal companions, spiritual beings, groups of people perhaps. What you're doing is, by thinking about them, in terms of the structure of taking in the good, you're trying to produce a positive experience in yourself, of feeling cared about one way or another, which covers a lot of ground. It includes feeling seen, empathized with. You're thinking of things that stir up experiences like this. Feeling cared about also includes feeling liked or part of a group, that you matter to someone, that you're appreciated, perhaps. In other words, feeling cared about could include one or more of these various different things. And it could also include feeling loved and cherished. So I'll be quiet for a few moments here as you attempt to cultivate in yourself, as a wholesome factor, the experience of feeling cared about by one or more beings and cared about in one or more ways. And as you do this, as you increasingly savor this experience of being cared about, also intend and sense that it is sinking into you. It's becoming a part of you that you can take with you wherever you go. You might have particular feelings in the region of the heart. It's also fine for there to be a sense of your own caring in response to being cared about, a sense of your own love or kindness. Being present here too. Feeling loved and loving, broadly defined.